I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy.
May the turbulence of our age yield to the true time of peace, when men and nations shall share a life that honors the dignity of each, the brotherhood of all.
I see a world of open borders, open trade, and most importantly, open mind.
Hello and welcome to The Republic, a show dedicated to history, civics, and U.S. institutions. I'm your host, Jake.
And I'm Matt.
In this episode, we're going to be talking about international relations. In our last few episodes that you and I have done, we've talked about international institutions and a bit about U.S.-China relations on kind of a bilateral basis, but I think we're going to try to take it back to the basics with this one. Well, we kind of discussed the episode a little bit, but before we start, I wanted to talk about KXRW and the kind of the mission that we're looking at doing, and we're just bringing a voice to the Vancouver and Clark County communities. We're also air on X-Ray, which reaches as far south as Eugene. So it's a great opportunity. If anybody's really interested in donating, that would be great to keep us on the air. You can do so at kxrwvancouver.org. There's a donate button right in the top right-hand corner. And check out some of the other shows that are on KXRW. There's some great ones. If you want to get into local politics, Filibusters with John Oberg and Mike D'Alessandro have some great interviews. They just interviewed Governor Inslee and State Senator Annette Cleveland. The Common Good with Joe Clemens is another great show. I love listening to them. Joe is a great guy. And then if you like music, there are some great eclectic music shows on KXRW. The Mud Club with Ivan, Gordon Green's Music Planet, and The Vibe with Ryan Reed. So now that that's all been taken care of, we can start the episode. So I think with like we did with the international relations one, I kind of wanted to start with a quiz. And I think if you'll be my guinea pig, Matt, I'll ask you these questions and we will go from there. So question one, what is international relations theory?
That is a tough one because it kind of is in the name. It's essentially providing a framework in which we view relations between states and how they, you know, interact with one another through the various frameworks of general IR theory. You know, there's, like we've hinted to, there's multiple schools of thought, and it's kind of combining all of them to view how each state kind of interacts with each other within these kind of frameworks and these ideas.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good answer. It's interesting because international relations is kind of like a verb, right? And like it's something that states do together.
Yeah.
But international relations theory tries to add a theoretical framework to that. So it's like, how can we go about studying international relations? And it's rooted in the broader umbrella that is the political science doctrine and then social sciences more generally. And so it's just trying to analyze how states, and by states we mean countries, nation states, but we just say states for short. Otherwise, if you're saying countries or nation states all the time, that can get kind of repetitive. But when we say states throughout this episode, just know that we mean countries. So yeah, that's basic international relations theory. And I know it's a topic that is it's a subdiscipline that I know is very near and dear to both of our hearts. We took several classes on that in college, and I went on to start a master's program in that discipline. So it's a lot of fun. And I think it really helps. I think this episode will really help add a good perspective to our listeners in terms of how to view the international realm. Because I think that when you have an understanding of theoretical basis in terms of how interactions are wrote about, and then also how to predict state behavior, it's a good tool to have, you know, in the back of your mind. So question number two. What are the three main schools of thought within international relations?
I do know this one. It is realism, liberalism, and constructivism.
That is correct. And we'll get into those three throughout the episode.
Yeah.
So we'll just put a pin in that for now and move on to question number three. Which Enlightenment-era philosopher brought political theory to modern society?
That is a good one. I always mess this up because I always think it's someone who came later. But I believe, and correct me with his first name, it is Thomas Hobbes.
That is correct. Yes, Thomas Hobbes. We've talked about him a little bit on our Republican Party episode, but the Thomas Hobbes was a early Enlightenment era philosopher. The Enlightenment period spanned from about the 1650s until the early 1800s. And basically, what that did is it brought a lot of questions and thinking about society and power and politics. These really novel concepts, stuff that we kind of take for granted now and don't really think about, but you know, a lot of his ideas, a lot of the, you know, others like Kant, Rousseau, who I'm thinking you were Rousseau wrote in the mid-1700s as a response to Hobbes' theory, as a critique of Hobbes' theory. But yeah, Thomas Hobbes, a very would be considered, if we were to put him in a camp, one of those schools of thought would definitely be it's hard, and we'll discuss this. Is he a realist or is he a liberalist? Mm. Because when we talk about autonomy and attunement, he's kind of falls in the middle of both. So question number four, and the last one, History of the Peloponnesian War was written by which great Greek philosopher?
This is also a trick one, because I always think it's Herodotus, but it's not Herodotus.
That was the father of history.
History, yeah. But it's actually Thucydides.
Thucydides, correct. Yeah. And I know we talked briefly about Thucydides on our Chinese episode, yeah. On our China-US relations episode. Mm-hmm. And it's really important in terms of IR theory, both Hobbes and Thucydides give us the first real illustrations of political thought and how to think about man and the state and this thing concept that we call politics. Thucydides wrote about the Peloponnesian War was the war between Spartans and Athens. Mm-hmm. And Thucydides was writing, it's not really like a history per se. He wasn't really documenting mm-hmm. events. He was writing a dialogue about his memories of the Peloponnesian War.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is really, you know, there's a lot of metaphor. There's a lot of, he definitely, uses a lot of theatrics, but mm-hmm. it's an interesting read, especially the Melian dialogue, which is what I want to bring up when we talk about realism. And that discussion between the powerful Athens and then Milos, which is this little Tylian island nation, Thucydides writes this fictional dialogue between these two powers asymmetrical relationship. And it's really interesting. I really highly recommend reading it if anybody wants to have something to read while they're quarantined. That's definitely a good one to read. So I think with that, we'll move on to, I think with any discussion in international relations and really any sort of, you know, political science, you have to start with talking about Hobbesian theory of the state. Mm. And really in this concept of anarchy, we hear anarchy all the time, like there's anarchists and all that kind of stuff, but really what is anarchy? Do you want to nail that down for us?
Yeah. So for anarchy, the way I always thought about it when I was learning about it was the absence of power, like a specific central power. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the way I look at it is when we're looking at IR theory, when we're looking at the world, we are in some points in our history lacking an absence of a one sole power, and there's various other powers competing with each other to attain power. Mm-hmm. I know I'm kind of leaning into a bit of realism here, sure. But that's kind of what I'm thinking with, at least with you know, the biggest thing is just the absence of power, like mm-hmm. or a central power.
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty much hits a nail on the head. Is that there's no governing body above the individual, yeah. Right? So every actor within the system has complete autonomy to do whatever they want. Mm. So Hobbes talks about how mm-hmm. that system with no centralized authority leads man's life in what he calls the natural state. Mm-hmm. And man's natural state of nature is selfish, brutish, and short mm-hmm. when under anarchy. And so he wrote his book called The Leviathan mm-hmm. around the time of the English Civil War. And what he was arguing was that with the absence of centralized authority, everything breaks down into chaos. Yes. Because you're talking about, and this is like getting into some of the realism tenets here, but it's you can't trust other individuals because you don't know their intentions. You can't mm-hmm. know their intentions. Yeah. So you have to resort to self-help strategies. You have mm-hmm. to resort, you have to fall back onto what do I have to do to survive? Because I can only trust myself mm-hmm. to survive. And so what Hobbes was very much a monarchist during the English Civil War. We don't mm-hmm. have to get into the history of that, but what he was really arguing for was the maintaining of the absolute monarchy in England, which mm-hmm. is absolute power. That means that the power mm-hmm. In the monarchy is completely 100% given to one central authority,
yeah.
which is the king. And so he would argue that even democracy, which is better than complete anarchy, doesn't go far enough because mm-hmm. there's too many voices. When Hobbes would argue that with more voices, the more voices that you have, the more misconception there can be, and there are more different interests competing with each other, and therefore you're always going to have breakdowns. Because he actually blamed the English Civil War on Parliament and the splitting of power between the monarchy and Parliament. That's getting a little probably too in the weeds, but just know that Hobbes's escape from nature and that brutish life is that humans, individuals, subject themselves to the absolute power of the Leviathan, the state. And then the state therefore has an obligation to protect the individual. Mm-hmm. But at that point, individuals have completely lost all of their, individuals pretty much lose all of their autonomy when they enter into that contract, but they gain protection in that escape from that anarchy. Mm-hmm. Obviously that is probably a little more than what we would like to, right? Mm-hmm. We've grown up in a democracy. We grew up in with a lot of personal freedoms. But I think it's still understanding that the role of the state is important. Mm-hmm. Even if it's not to the level of Hobbes, mm-hmm. right? Okay, so with that, did you have anything else you wanted to add on Hobbes?
No, that's pretty much summed it up. I think the biggest thing is just kind of what I always took away from reading specifically the Leviathan is that the central power of the state always seems to be his main concern, and that specific, and I'm not saying like for his case was an absolute monarchy, but just having that overarching power to kind of, like you said, like quell the many voices is his way to mitigate chaos and the chaotic effects of anarchy.
Mm-hmm. And I think you see that when you talk about, you know, the role of the state. I think the state itself acts as kind of an arbiter in a coordinating position that help with cooperation between individuals. And I think you see a lot of times when there is no centralized authority, there's no leadership, cooperation breaks down considerably because everybody has competing self-interests. When you have that leader who has the power and the authority, that they can then mobilize society in a larger way to move towards a single goal. And that's why Hobbes has a lot of interesting things you can take from him in his book Leviathan, where you start to really see the theoretical importance of the state. So I think with that, we'll take a quick break. On the opposite side of the break, I think we'll break into kind of the lesson plan for today, which is stating a question that I actually posed to you, and then we'll start our discussion on the three main schools of thought in international relations theory. So with that, we're going to take a quick break. I'm Jake.
And I'm Matt.
And we'll be right back.
A big thank you to Vancouver's own Kagan's Theatre for supporting our radio community. Our historic Kagan's Theater has a long tradition of showing movies for our community, 85 years. Kagan's currently features first-run big studio and art house films along with classic movie revival. Check out their live events, and you can even book the theater for a private party or public event. Go to kagans-theater.com to see how you can rediscover the joy of going out for movie night again. Showtimes, booking information, and more at KagansTheater.com.
KXRW would like to thank Craft Cannabis, our exclusive cannabis sponsor, for supporting our radio community. Craft Cannabis for 21 and over now has two locations in Vancouver. The newest shop is on Andreessen Road off Patton Parkway, next to Home Depot. At this location, they offer Top Shelf Tuesday, Waxy Wednesday, and Stony Sunday specials. The Mill Plain location is in the Heights Shopping Center with Munchy Monday and Saturday specials. Ordering options include online, in person, curbside, and express window touchless pickups to better serve you. Hours and more information available at craftcannabis.com.
Community Radio Like This is brought to you by the generous support by our founding sponsors at ADCO Commercial Printing and Graphics, Clark County's local print shop since 1993. ADCO features stationery, posters, flyers, tickets, business cards, stickers, catalogs, and much more. Print on anything and mail anywhere. Learn more at adco1.com. That's ADCO, the number 1.com.
Welcome back to the Republic. I'm Jake.
And I'm Matt.
In our last episode, we talked about international relations theory, what it is, where it kind of came from, the theoretical basis of where interactions between actors in an anarchic environment started, and it started with Thomas Hobbes and as far back as the mid-1600s. In this segment, we're going to really delve deep into the three main schools of thought within international relations theory, which are realism, liberalism, and constructivism. So I think what we will start with is posing a question that I wrote, and we're going to try to answer it from the three main schools of thought. And I think that what this will do is it'll really allow our listeners to kind of get a little bit firmer grasp on the distinction between and importance of the distinction between these schools of thought and how these schools of thought could ultimately affect policy for U.S. Foreign policy, for U.S. foreign policy, and then also just the mapping and the shaping of the international community that we see today with international organizations. So that question is, Helmut Kohl, the former chancellor of West Germany, said in 1983, peace must be more than the absence of war. How would someone from each of the three main schools of thought in international relations explain this quote? So, I think with that, what we should probably, do you want to talk now about realism?
Yeah, I think that'd be a good start for us is to start with realism.
Okay. Did you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. So with realism, realism really breaks down to its main focus is on power and states' interaction with power. What we kind of touched on briefly with Hobbes is the nature of power and anarchy. There's a lot of uncertainty in states' interactions with each other because we don't know other states' intents. So we don't know what's going on in their heads. And so we're kind of playing this dance with other states, trying to predict their interaction in this anarchic environment that we call the world. I don't know if you say like a separate off branch of realism. I don't know if we want to talk too much about neo-realism.
We probably should. I mean, some of the more modern realists who are talking about international relations theory specifically are going to be neo-realists.
Yeah.
The difference between realism and neo-realism really is looking at states as an extension of individuals.
Yeah, and I also think it's important that we also mention about humans' interactions with the environment of anarchy. Because I know you mentioned to me previously off the air, there is no way to escape the anarchy that surrounds us. So it's basically humans' interests to be selfish, to put their interests first, and to basically act from within rather than relying on others to meet their needs.
Yeah, I think you're definitely hitting on a very key component of realism, and that is that anarchy is inescapable, especially at the international realm. Where we'll get into liberalism in a little bit, but liberalism offers a counter to that. And basically what they're arguing is that anarchy in itself, this environment where every actor has relatively the same amount of power, but there's no centralized authority, which is what we talked about in the last segment. Within that environment, that environment has a causal effect on behavior. So it's a deterministic view on behavior that you are always going to have to resort to yourself. If the environment is forcing you because you can't trust other people and you can't know their interests, you're going to result to self-help logic and view every interaction as zero sum. Mm-hmm. So that means every interaction that I'm going to have with you, I'm going to view it through the lens of how can I maximize what I feel I need to continue to survive in the system. And classical realists looked at that dynamic between individuals and anarchy at the individual level, whereas neo-realists try to attribute that same behavior that you see in individuals in that environment and then attribute it to the international system, because anarchy doesn't really exist that much between individuals anymore with the creation of the nation state. Mm-hmm. So real true anarchy, and even people within the liberal doctrine will assume the same thing, that the international realm, which is in political science is called the structural level of analysis. So looking at interactions between states above the state, above the state level, is anarchic because there is no centralized authority. States are sovereign. Mm-hmm. That means there's really no power, no legitimated authority that can tell a state what to do. Mm-hmm. And that makes international relations very, very difficult because everybody has their own interests. Everybody has their own principles, their values, and the things that they're going to look out. And they're going to look out for themselves. And there's nobody that can tell them without the raw use of power and force from a more powerful state to tell any other state what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. There's bouts of cooperation, but even a realist would say that cooperation is generally only is short-lived because it's only in the state's interest that they have that cooperation. Mm-hmm. And once those interests diverge, that cooperation breaks down, mm-hmm. Which makes trying to cooperate on a long-run scale very, very difficult. And realists are going to maintain that this is, this is the system. There's no escaping it. Mm-hmm. Some of the classical realists are going to be, Thucydides, in that we talk about the Melian dialogue. Did you want to get into the Melian dialogue at all?
Yes, because it has one of the greatest lines of all time.
Okay. What was that?
It's specifically between Athens and Milos. Mm-hmm. Again, Athens being the dominant power, and Milos being a much more minor power. Milos had been relatively unaligned. I know they were, I think from what I remember, they were technically more aligned with Sparta, but they really were kind of playing it. They were pretty much riding the fence on this one. They were trying to stay out of it as best they could. But Athens came and, was basically like, either join us or, die. And the Melians were like, we really have no part in this. We're not a major power. We'd like to stay out of this, please. And the Athens said, and I will forever remember this line because I always feel like it belongs in Star Wars. The strong do what they can, the weak suffer what they must. Mm-hmm. And that is, if not the most Empire Strikes Back line I've ever heard in my life. But it really does also summarize the core tenets of realism, mm-hmm. is that strong states act strongly, weak states are subservient to the stronger states.
Mm-hmm. In that is this real deterministic view of behavior. Mm. Athens saw themselves as we are the dominant power. This is what we do.
Yeah.
We conquer.
Yeah.
We go out, and because we view maximizing power, mm-hmm. as conquering other people, mm-hmm. as central to our survival. Mm-hmm. So that's what we have to do to survive within the system, mm-hmm. is we have to conquer all these lands. So that way there's no one who can rival us, and we can, mm-hmm. our way of life, our country, our state, mm-hmm. continues to, it can continue to survive, mm-hmm. through generations. So that's, that gets us into a little bit of a split within the broader framework of realism, which is power maximization versus security maximization. Mm-hmm. And you would think that those could be synonyms, but they're not. There's a good point of difference there. In John J. Mearsheimer, who is a power maximizing realist, who would take what Thucydides said and said, yes. Like, you, in order to survive, you have to be the most dominant power. You have to go out and conquer, because that is the only way that you can, that is the only way that you can for sure say that you're going to survive, is by being the biggest kid on the block with the biggest stick, mm-hmm. and making sure that you are more powerful than any conglomerate of states or any other state by itself cannot rival you, and mm-hmm. therefore they're not going to attack you because they know it's futile. They're not going to win. Mm-hmm. That's why Milos didn't attack Athens. They were trying to call to Athens's higher power, higher ideals, and saying, we're nothing to you. But Athens responded with, you're weak, you must suffer what you must.
Yeah.
And because in that system, and under the realist ideology, that's how the system works. Mm-hmm. And so, contrastly to Mearsheimer's power maximization theory, you have what Kenneth Waltz would call balance of power theory, but then it's also security maximization. Mm-hmm. That by pursuing just absolute power, what you'd actually do is make yourself less secure. What Kenneth Waltz has also called defensive realism would argue that you want to build up your your country's defenses, your state's defenses, enough to ward off any sort of outside influence or possibility of attack. But what you don't want to do is by going out and projecting that power, what you do is you may, even if you are doing it, your interest there is just only to build you up your own security so nobody comes and attacks you. You don't want to then go conquer anybody. What you do is, because no one can know your interests, they're going to start building up themselves. And that's when you get into that, they start building up their own capabilities. And you get into what they call the security dilemma, which is, I can't trust, because I can't trust your intentions. I see you building all of these missiles over here. I don't know what you're going to use those missiles for. All I know is that they can be used against me. So I'm going to start building up my missile systems. And the next thing you know, you have these arm races, and then you get a flashpoint like in World War One, and you end up in a catastrophic war. So that is, that would be, because Kenneth Waltz in his book, The Prospects of War, Neorealist Theory, talks about World War One as an example. So I think with that, what we'll do now is to move on to liberalism. And did you want to discuss liberalism at all?
Yeah, for me, liberalism is a direct response to realism. Specifically, it's that there are the same assumptions, like we mentioned, about states' behaviors in the anarchic system that we find ourselves in. However, they believe there is a way to escape essentially the madness, the dog-eat-dog world of realism. And that is through several ways. I mean, there's structural liberalism, where we view that states through structures like, for example, the UN, EU, world, you know, these multilateral organizations, these can in a way intertwine the world in a way that it makes the costs of going to war too great to actually want to go through with it.
Oh, I love that you bring that up, because it's understanding that states have their own interests and making war so much more costly than cooperation.
Yeah.
It becomes the interests of the state to cooperate.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's, I think that's really good that you pointed that out. So what else did you take from liberalism?
One of my big points is that just that institutions remove the uncertainty of the anarchic system overall that realists really depend upon for their theory.
Sure.
Essentially, it's trying to mitigate the effects of anarchy. So, for example, I mentioned the EU. It's one of my favorite organizations to use when we're talking about liberalism, because Europe has been known to have a few wars here and there.
A few. One or two.
But when you have things like the EU, where there's a lot of states cooperating on trade, on immigration, on various aspects of international relations and international engagement.
Sure.
You see that, why would France declare war on Spain when they have high levels of trade? They have, it would be against their own interest if to have some expansionary war or some, you know, war of aggression, because in the end, they profit from this agreement, from this arrangement, from the structure of the EU more than they would if they went to war over some resource or some other, for some de facto power issue.
You hit that right on the head with that. That's perfectly put, Matt. To kind of, I guess, build off of what you were saying is that there's a great article out there. It's one of my favorites I ever read in school, and it's by an international relations theorist named Barbara Corominos. She wrote the article titled "The Rational Design of International Institutions." In this really seminal piece of that is like structural liberalism, like put on the paper, what she attempts to do is, where are the areas that states, that prohibit states from cooperating over a long period of time, and what can those institutions do? What kind of mechanisms can you put in these institutions that help alleviate the fears that states have under anarchy? Because liberalism does assume that behavior under anarchy is deterministic. Through what kind of mechanisms and institutional arrangements can you put in that help alleviate those concerns over not knowing interests, over zero sum logic? Which is zero sum logic is that anytime that if you're gaining if you're gaining at all, it means that in my mind, I am not gaining. Mm-hmm. Whereas that's not inherently true, because we could both be making gains. We could both be not losing, but because I'm worried about relative gains, mm-hmm. that if you're doing better relative to me, that means I'm losing. Mm-hmm. But obviously we know that to not be true, because take China and the United States, for example. The United States and China, through their trade agreements, have both benefited. Mm-hmm. Their GDPs have both risen. Mm-hmm. But because China's GDP has risen at a faster pace than the United States, someone with a zero-sum logic, operating under zero-sum logic, would view that the United States is actually declining relative to China, when mm-hmm. they're not. Mm-hmm. We're both boats are rising.
Are you saying that the tide lifts all boats?
I don't know. Is this a metaphor for capitalism?
Maybe.
So a couple of those things that Barbara Corominos brings up is the most important one, in my opinion, is leadership. Having mm-hmm. that centralized authority within the institution that can alleviate some of those issues. Fairness, representation, punishment, and reward mechanisms, I think, are also really mm-hmm. key, because if a state wants to defect, because that's one of the biggest things, is you don't want to have that sucker's payoff.
Yeah.
Is if I enter in a cooperation with you, and then you turn around and screw me over, I'm left holding the bag.
Yeah.
In an anarchy, I don't have any way to punish you for that if I don't have the power to do so. Yeah. So what institutional arrangements will try to do is saying, like, okay, we have this more centralized authority, and wherever that comes, whether it's like a single state, or if that's a conglomerate of states that meet almost like a Congress would, where there's like the UN General Assembly, for instance, can then say that we're going to punish state X because they didn't comply with the rules that they agreed upon when they became members of this institution. Yeah. And so what liberalism is trying to do is take the things that we know work at the state level, democracy, representation, and take those values and those principles and attribute them to the international realm, which is defined by anarchy, by bringing some sort of governance to this system.
Mm.
I think that does a pretty good job of explaining it.
Yeah, so let's move on to the last one.
I think before we do that, we're up against a break here, so we'll talk about constructivism, which is its own weird kind of amalgamation of thoughts. It's very different than liberalism and realism. So I think with that, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, we will talk about the school of thought of constructivism, which is a much more modern international relations school of thought. It draws on ideas, but we'll get into that on the other side of the break. And then we'll just have a free-flowing discussion about how each one of these schools, someone within each of these three schools of thought, would try to answer that question that we posed earlier in this segment. Mm-hmm. So you've been listening to The Republic. I'm Jake.
And I'm Matt.
And we'll be right back.
Big thank you to Kraft Cannabis, formerly known as New Amsterdam, for supporting our radio community. Kraft Cannabis now has two locations here in Vancouver. Both locations offer online ordering and curbside pickup. The Mill Plain location has an express window that serves as a contactless option to pick up your cannabis products. The newest shop is located on Andreessen Road, off Paddon Parkway, next to the Home Depot, across from Costco. Both locations are open daily, 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. More information available at craftcannabis.com. KXRW programming is made possible by the generous support by David Dansky with David's Toys, buyer and collector of old toy trains, including Lionel, Flyer, Ives, and Marks. He is interested in buying old transportation-related toys as well as toy trains from the late 1800s to the 1960s. David offers appraisals for fellow toy train lovers as well. David's Toys can be reached at 360-576-1602. That's 360-576-1602.
The community angels at National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation have been supporters of KXRW Community Radio since our inception. NWK helps to inform and educate the prevention of violence against women and children. They have a dream, a world without violence. Learn more about how you can help at nwcave.org.
Welcome back to The Republic. I'm Jake.
And I'm Matt.
In our last segment, we talked about the two older schools of thought within international relations theory, which, to restate, international relations theory is a theoretical concept on how countries interact with each other and tries to make models and predict and analyze that behavior through a quantitative way, which is try to break down that into numbers. And it's a really fascinating school of thought, and it's one that you and I both really like, and that's why we kind of decided to do this episode. So the two schools of thought that we talked about were realism and liberalism. And before we started talking about that, though, I want to restate the question. So if you're tuning in now, you have somewhat of an idea of what we're talking about. And the question is I'll just restate it here, is Helmut Kohl, the former chancellor of West Germany, said in 1983, "Peace must be more than the absence of war." How would someone from each of the three main schools of thought in international relations explain this quote? So like I said, we talked about realism and liberalism on the other side of the break. And now I think we're going to talk about the third in kind of the stepchild of international relations theory, which is constructivism.
Yeah.
Did you want to break that down?
Yeah. My biggest take from constructivism is the world is what you make of it. And we more of how our ideas shape the world around us.
Mm-hmm.
So like, for example, I always think of it not really in the terms of states, but my best way of thinking of it is looking at like the dollar. Okay. Specifically, a dollar is a piece of paper, but we give it worth. Mm-hmm. We agree that a dollar is worth a dollar. And then I try to apply it more to the macro with the United States.
Sure.
We all agree that we live in a country called the United States. We have ideas about what that country means to us. You can mm-hmm. look at it, like the Constitution or, you know, the Bill of Rights or and these ideas that we all hold is what we essentially turn into the United States.
Sure.
And our actions reflect our understanding and our ideas of that nation.
Yeah.
So then if you want to even apply it to a more macro level, you can look at like how states interact with each other is based on maybe our ideas of what our own intents are and our own purpose. We are states are almost in a way reflections of what we view each other as. Like our ideas shape our states' actions in a way.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I've always looked at.
Yeah, I think you're right on with that. That ideas play mm-hmm. a major role mm-hmm. in the shaping of behavior. And that stands in stark contrast to liberalism and realism, which mm-hmm. argue that anarchy, which is the absence of a centralized power, that environment has a causal effect, that has a deterministic effect on behavior, that people within that anarchic system are going to behave in a certain way because of the environmental realities around them. Whereas a constructivist would come back and argue, no, that's not deterministic because we're all blank slates. Mm-hmm. So what ultimately ends up influencing behavior is a long process of messaging, signaling, and interpreting. That over time, if you and I interacting with each other, I see how you react to me saying something or me doing something, mm-hmm. and therefore I can then predict what you're going to do based off of what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, that's self-reinforcing.
Yeah.
And that in itself it's not saying that there is any sort of way or any sort of particular way we're going to act. We act because of past experiences.
Yeah.
And in expectations off of those past experiences. So because we see anarchy as creating a life of, you know, that short, brutish and selfish, it's that way because that's how humans have acted towards each other. So therefore that's what we anticipate happening. So then we act off of that anticipation.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a fine line here, but they're basically saying is that we're not stuck in anarchy. We can escape anarchy. And what Alexander Wendt, who's kind of like the father of constructivist thought in international relations, wrote in his real seminal piece called Anarchy is What States Make of It, The Social Construction of Power Politics. Mm-hmm. And that is, we are who we are and how we see ourselves, that coat we put on ourselves really influences our identity. And then we act to fill that role. So like there's this idea of you're American.
Mm-hmm.
So how do Americans act? So then you change your behavior to act as you think, as society thinks mm-hmm. you should act as an American.
Mm-hmm.
Like do you act differently when you put on a suit versus when you're wearing casual clothing?
I never wear suits.
You never wear suits? All right. So I mean, if you're dressed up and you go out nice, there's almost like this social pressure that you need to act in a certain way
yeah.
versus when you're wearing just casual clothes out and about, that there's there isn't that pressure to act in a certain way. So it's kind of taking that idea and saying, how does that affect state relations? So if you're the dominant power in the system, right, and this is kind of gets back into Thucydides a little bit, is where does constructivism situate itself a little bit in more established realist thought or liberalist thought, and saying that if you're the dominant power, you're going to act in a certain way because you think that that is how a dominant power is supposed to act. If you're America, you're the sole world hegemon. Or if you're a democracy, right? I think this is a better analogy, is that if you're a democracy and you uphold these ideas of self-determination and free institutions and representation, equal rights for all, is that that's how you're going to project yourself on the international stage, is you're going to be like, we're going to uphold this is because this is who we are. Mm-hmm. This is how we're going to act because this is the coat we put on ourselves. Mm-hmm. And over time that has it has this profound effect on behavior. So was there anything else that you would want to add about constructivism?
No, that pretty much sums it up, I think.
Okay, sure. Like I said, Alexander Wendt, you can find the free PDF online. I just Googled it. It's called Anarchy is What States Make of It, The Social Construction of Power Politics. I'd recommend looking up all of those, the Barbara Corominos article, the Kenneth Waltz article. Those are all very seminal pieces. They're dense reads, but they're good reads. So I think now that we've kind of broken down the three main schools of thought, I think we'll just have an open discussion about how each school of thought would answer that question. All right, Matt, so how would a realist explain how peace must be more than the absence of war?
Yeah, I think for realism, like we talked, the big point is power. What is the balance of power after a war?
Mm-hmm.
Usually the balance of power is, on the side of the victor. And we're looking at what kind of world we're in. Is it a bipolar world where power is balanced between two great powers? Is it a multipolar world where there's multiple powers vying for control? Or is it a unipolar world? And I think we have to look at it from a perspective of where is power placed at the time of peace. For example, following World War II, we saw a really... I think a brief period of monopolarity immediately followed by a bipolar world with the USSR and the USA.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was neither one could get the advantage over the other. And so, and both were, and you could also argue that there was a period of nuclear deterrence as well.
Yeah,
so that
there definitely was.
That also puts up, I think if we're just trying to not get too much in the weeds, the important thing to take from what a realist I think would look at is, the balance of power is in a way where someone can get the advantage over the other. Mm-hmm. And so they cannot, like, for example, attack the other.
Yeah.
So for example, like, with the Melian dialogue,
mm-hmm.
Milos wasn't going to attack Athens.
No,
there was no way.
No,
but that also didn't prevent war.
No,
I mean, Athens attacked Milos. Mm-hmm. In this case, the cost of war for a minor power to attack, let's look at the USA.
Sure.
Even if it's China, mm-hmm. the closest rival, is far too great for there to be any benefit or change in the power complex where China comes out on top.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a realist would say the absence of war or the absence of war is really dictated by the balance of power.
Sure.
And where power lies in the international system.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right on with that. I think realists, there's like anything, there's not going to be one answer out of the school of thought of realism, but I think that there's a couple dominant ones, and I think when you talk about it's going to be structural, right? There needs to be some there within the current balance of power. There needs to be something that keeps states from fighting amongst each other, mm-hmm. and whether that is a Leviathan type mm-hmm. state where you have you were talking about a unipolar world. That means there's one power that no other power in itself can rival, that can dominate everything, be that one voice
mm-hmm.
in keeping everybody else in line. Or you have what you call a balance of power, which is because in using the United States and the USSR as the example, which I think you rightly did, is that they could each of those dominant powers acted like a Leviathan in themselves within their own spheres of influence.
Mm-hmm.
So Russia could control the behavior of the states within its sphere of influence, and the United States could do that within its own sphere of influence. And I think you see that with the Suez Canal incident in the 1950s, mm-hmm. where England and France were going, once Egypt had nationalized the Suez Canal and closed it off to transport, that directly hurt trade for European powers. And France and England went to invade Egypt, but Egypt was aligned with Russia, and fearing that this could turn into a hot war, which would force the United States and Russia to go to war over something that weaker states at the time were doing, told England and France, back off. England and France listened. That is such an indication of the relative balance of power and power dynamics within the system, that ultimately these proud nations of France, these former empires, listened to the new toughest kid on the block and changed their behavior. So I think that in itself shows how balance of power can have a direct effect on curbing violence, if it's done in the, you know, obviously if it's done in the right way and the right conditions are met and all the right, you have the right kind of power. But there's a lot that plays into it. So it's either that Leviathan or that balance of power, I think, is how different realists would go about explaining that. So we'll move on to liberalism, and how would somebody in the liberalist school of thought explain this?
I think this one will also be more applicable to the period following directly after World War II. I think they would see it as structures and institutions really mitigate the prospect of war, because we become so entangled and engaged in trade, in diplomacy, in just mutual cooperation, that the costs of going to war are just too high. For example, let's just say, I always like to return to the EU because it's one of my favorites. It's one of the more applicable scenarios. For example, let's just say there was a mighty war between Denmark and Estonia, the greatest powers of Europe. let's just say they were in a hostile environment. But they're both EU members. They're involved in trade. They're involved in, they have immigration policies that affect each other. And Denmark just really wants to stick it to Estonia. Well, war just isn't really a viable option because they have profitable trade deals. They are getting scholars from Estonia to come work in their IT projects. Denmark is shipping over lots of pork because they are the number one pig producer in Europe. No joke. I know that. It's just a random
fact.
Well,
you're Danish.
I am Danish. But it just comes to the point where, in the end, war just becomes too costly.
It does.
And mutual cooperation wins the day because both parties, even when they're angry with each other, still prosper when cooperating. So it promotes this idea of mutual cooperation. And so it's a structural theory. In my mind, I tend to lean towards more of a structural liberal idea of how the absence of war isn't just, or the presence of peace isn't just the absence of war. It's the presence of cooperation, institutional structures that essentially mitigate anarchy by guiding states towards specific answers to resolve their problems.
And I think that there's a matrix I had in my notes that I had sent you, and it's this 4x4 matrix. And I think that what this question is getting at is that we can't just assume that peace, we want to make peace lasting, and we just can't define peace as the periods between different conflicts. And so what has to be present to keep the next conflict from happening? And I think where liberalism would fall on this 4x4 matrix, where on the top you have autonomy and attunement, and then on the sides you have impermeable and permeable. So that how responsive are states to outside influences? Like a realist would fall at the intersection of autonomy and impermeable. So that these hard billiard balls are there's these created nation states that just bash against each other, and there's not really a lot of melding there. Liberalism, I think, would fall where you would have attunement and impermeable, that you have these hard boundary nation states that are going to do the things that they want to do within their boundaries, but they have attuned themselves to some sort of higher power, or some institution that can then dictates their behavior a little bit, and they've attuned themselves to going along to get along because they understand that they benefit more when they cooperate. So that probably gets a little confusing. And then you have permeable in autonomy, which would be constructivism, would be the intersection of autonomy and permeable, where actors are more likely to change versus being more rigid, like a hard billiard ball, which would be impermeable. Anyway, I think you hit the head right there, hit it on the head with the creation of institutions that promote cooperation, just to keep reinforcing that, because it's eventually convincing states that they can benefit sacrificing short-run gains for long-term stability, because in the long run, we're all going to be better off when we cooperate.
Yeah.
And we don't have to get into Prisoner's Dilemma or Tragedy of the Commons to really talk about that. But there's a lot of theoretical concepts and ideas that reinforce this more liberalist idea of school of thought.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so that's me rambling a little bit. So let's get on to constructivism. How would a constructivist answer this question?
Yeah, I think this is a little bit of the trickier of the three, but I think the biggest thing I would think a constructivist would argue is the absence of, or the presence of peace being more than the absence of war, is that we agree, that we all have an understanding that the presence of peace is what we strive to attain, and that the absence of war is also an ideal we strive for, and that I think we develop a shared understanding that peace is the ultimate goal.
Yeah,
peace is what we strive for, and then then states reflect these ideals. Is kind of what I'd get into, and I know you probably would have to. You wanted to add that note you made that. It's ideas leading to action in a way, or ideas leading to structure.
Ideas become interests.
So
constructivism, like you were talking about with interests, ideas becoming the interests of actors within the system. And so that what a constructivist would say is that ideals of peace, ideals of co-prosperity in the democracy, institutions, the stuff that help alleviate those tensions amongst competing states with competing interests, is that if you have these states that see themselves as peaceful, they're going to act peaceful. And I think that stands in stark contrast, and coming back to that Melian dialogue, that is, if Athens had saw themselves as a peaceful nation versus a conquering nation, maybe they would have viewed the power dynamic between them and Milos differently. So a constructivist would say is that we want to promote through all sorts of different avenues, whether it's through institutions, whether it's through balance of power, whether is that you put these ideas out there, and hopefully over time these ideas reinforce these concepts of peaceful negotiation, stuff like that. So I think a really good piece of literature, really quick to talk about when it comes to constructivism, would be a book called Just and Unjust Wars. And it's by an author called his name is Michael Walzer. And what he talks about in this book is that one of the classic lines from this is that through the justifications of war, we gain moral knowledge. So that way, so that in itself shows that there is something a little bit more, that we understand that there's this intersubjectivity when it comes to in how these ideas are at play and how they influence our behavior, and how they influence how we see the world, is that you never see somebody especially in the modern world, you never see somebody like Athens that just openly say, we're the dominant power, our job is to conquer all. Usually, anytime you see some actor use aggression towards another, whether it's a state using, in this instance, a state inflicting violence on another, there's all these justifications used. Like, we had to protect the citizens from its government. We had to do all of these different things. Like, what were the justifications for Afghanistan? What were the justifications for Iraq? There's always like these justifications that we had to do it, right? We had to do it because it was the right thing to do. And instead of just saying, well, it was just because we had interests at stake, we wanted oil, or we wanted this. The justifications paid homage to even if it wasn't that way, it was just because the leaders felt like they had to justify it in a rational way, in a calling to these higher ideals to justify their use of violence, shows how ideas are at play mm-hmm. in the international system. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really interesting read. I think something to think about, and I think it's kind of a good place to kind of wrap up with where we're at. Mm-hmm. So just to kind of do you want to recap this episode? Is there one thing that you want to leave our listeners with for this month? Yeah,
I think the one thing to leave us with is the understanding of international theory through lenses of power, structures, and ideals. Mm-hmm. I think those kind of will always lead you back to the three schools of thought and how to view IR theory or international relations theory. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to look at the world through all of these scopes, though I know most people usually tend to lean towards one or the other, but
sure.
I think it's still important to look at the world through all of these scopes to kind of get a better understanding of how states interact. Mm-hmm. And try to view specific interactions through these lenses kind of gives us a little bit more of an insight into how the world kind of operates.
Yeah, I think definitely. And I hope you all enjoyed this episode. I know I had a ton of fun doing
it. Yeah,
this
me too.
Is something I've wanted to do for a long time. I love getting into the weeds of international relations theory and really talking about this on a conceptual basis. Because I really think that when you have the basics, and obviously no country or the world doesn't exist in those four little matrices boxes. And there's a lot of overlap between realism and liberalism and even constructivism. Yeah. And I think they all give us good insight into see and to try to predict and mm-hmm. understand why the world it is the way that it is. Mm-hmm. And I hope that this in some way gives our listeners the ability to see that. So mm-hmm. Thank you, Matt, again for being on. It's always a great discussion.
Yeah.
I love talking about these topics with you. So you always bring a really good, you always come with knowledge, and you always come with really good points and a few jokes too. So once again, appreciate it. And also appreciate the listeners. You guys make all of this possible. And once again, you're listening to the Republic. Have a great rest of your month. I'm Jake.
And I'm Matt.
See you next month.
Domestic violence is not okay, and it's on the rise, especially now during this time of COVID-19. Domestic violence comes in many forms, such as physical abuse, verbal, financial, sexual, stalking, and technological abuses. If you or someone you know is in an abusive relationship, we can help. The Vancouver Police Department and the YWCA are here for you. You are not alone, even in this time of crisis. You can call the YWCA at 360-695-0501 or call 911 for the police. You can also find helpful information about the Safe Choice Domestic Violence Program at ywcaclarkcounty.org and in Portland at ywcapdx.org. The Sierra Club empowers local volunteers to lead campaigns to protect the places and people we love. They empowered local volunteers to lead the effort in City Hall to develop an emissions reduction plan. The goal is to reduce emissions at least 50% by 2030. More information is available about how to become a member and support their work at sierraclub.org/Washington. That's sierraclub.org/Washington.
KXRW would like to thank Craft Cannabis, our exclusive cannabis sponsor, for supporting our radio community. Craft Cannabis for 21 and over now has two locations in Vancouver. The newest shop is on Andreessen Road off Patton Parkway, next to Home Depot. At this location, they offer Top Shelf Tuesday, Waxy Wednesday, and Stony Sunday specials. The Mill Plain location is in the Heights Shopping Center with Munchy Monday and Saturday specials. Ordering options include online, in person, curbside, and express window touchless pickups to better serve you. Hours and more information available at craftcannabis.com.